Okay. So I guess what I want for on Thursday is that you come up with a proposal for what you want to do your project on. I'm not going to grade your proposal, but it's important to me that you find out and have some idea of what it is you want to write a paper on, or you know, write some programs and do some experiments, or do basically what you're going to be working on. If you want, you can talk to me after class today. Okay, if you want to discuss some of the project topics, you know, or what you have ideas to what you want to do. Any questions about the project? Yes. I will be in the office after class till about a little before 4. So, you know, I'd be willing to talk to you guys then. Any questions? Okay. And again, when you can catch me in the next couple of days, it's also fair game. Any questions? What were people's, how many people went on the field trip that we had on a week from ago? Okay. How many people had a good time? That's the usual test. Okay. How many people had a bad time? Nobody says they had a bad time. What, did people learn anything? Or were there anything interesting come up? Okay. You know, anybody, I'm not sure, what did you see or find interesting? Yeah. Okay, so you said that, okay, well that's not one to the tape. Any other comments? Yes.
How expensive was the equipment?
So, the chips were about $500 a pop is what they said? Yeah, so that's, again, that motivates. One thing that I find interesting about biology is, again, how much of an economic science, or at least in the discovery parts of biology, how much of it is an economic thing? I mean, the question really is, you'd like to get some information, and you know, you want to drive the cost down to the point where you can actually get it, okay? And so, you know, so a lot of the questions of which experimental technology do you use is a function of cost. And somehow, you know, there's this race to discover things, and the winner, thank you very much, is the one that sort of gets the data before other people do, meaning that they saw that there was sort of this cost window to, you know, this opportunity in terms of the technology being just right enough that you can actually go and answer this kind of a question that you couldn't have answered before. And so, with micro arrays, the problem is that, you know, again, they're $500 a pop. And, you know, it means that to do a large-scale study on them, you have to be able to spend a lot of money, which means you have to convince people it's a very good study to do, okay? Or you've got to find cheaper ways to do the same thing. And so that's one reason why people spend so much time analyzing microarray data sets. So there are published microarray data sets, you know, that are well known. There's these Stanford yeast data sets. There's a lot of published microarray data sets. And a lot of people will, instead of running their own microarrays, try to use the clustering techniques or algorithmic techniques to try to mine the answer to the question they want from somebody else's data, because they're the ones that already paid for the microarrays. So that's one of the ideas. What other things did, anything else, other interesting things people saw or learned? Okay, anything that, yeah?
Which
experiment were you talking about, or what kind? Right.
Distinguish where there were many genes that were behaving, like they were made or not. But the point where the threshold goes is very clear.
Right. Look, if you're dealing with a laboratory science and the goal is to make something that works, you have a question you want to answer. And, you know, you can't necessarily answer them with mathematical, you know, with mathematical certainty. You know, so it's what you're saying is undoubtedly true. Okay, it's an interesting phenomenon that know, you look at this thing and you make a heuristic judgment, this is good enough or not. Okay? Any other interesting things? Yeah? So how did they... Okay, so what I think what you're saying is, I might be wrong, that the sequencing machines that they used were those produced by a relatively local, did they mention that being produced by a local company called Biophotonics, or does anyone know what the name, what was the brand name of the sequencing machine? Okay?
I don't know, but it was 2 years old.
It was 2 years old, okay. So what you may have been hearing about was, again, I assume that their sequencing machine worked the same way as our sequencing machines in that, you know, that you did tag your DNA fragments, you chopped them up and they ran down a gel. The only difference is really how were they read at the end. Okay, the same basic principle, the important principle as far as I'm concerned, is that you have the fragments running up and down this gel, perhaps this gel inside a capillary. That's probably the way that they did it. And the difference with the technology that you're probably talking about is how was the stuff read at the other end? Okay.
Also, in one sample, there could be sequence ending in an A, two, G, and T file.
Okay. So this is a a technology difference. It's not what I would call a conceptual difference, but it might be a significant practical difference. In the machines that we talked about in class, I sort of had this vision that there were different lanes for A, C, G, and C, and you were looking for the fragments as they went by. I think the machines that they're talking about, the difference is that the pieces that were cut at different bases, these were tagged essentially with different colors, okay, I don't know if you call them. Dyes, not really dyes, because but different fluorescent markers, okay, of different colors. One might be red, green, blue, and yellow, for all I know. Okay, you now mix these samples all together, run them on a gel, and then as you know, another way to view the idea that they're walking with it, that they walk a certain distance, is that they're walking at a certain speed. And the shorter fragments are walking faster. So you can sort of imagine that you have a camera, or in this case a laser set, a laser device, at the opening of the channel. And the fastest moving bases will slide out first. Using a laser, you can excite these fluorescent things. And depending on how you pulse that laser, you might sort of say, well, hey, now let's light up the green, let's light up the red, let's light up the yellow. Okay, and so that way you can get away with one lane, and you know, maybe less sample. Okay, so this may or may not be a better way to do it. Okay, but it's not conceptually that much different than what we've been talking about. Okay, it's basically still measuring lengths of fragments, and you know, it's just a question of how accurately you sense it. One reason why how accurately you sense it makes a difference is a lot of the cost of every sequencing reaction is these tags, these fluorescent tags. So if you build a machine that is much more sensitive and requires less sample and less tags, you might cut the cost of a sequencing reaction by a half or a third or something like that. And that could be an economically important. Okay? Any other things that came up in the tour that seems interesting? Okay? Okay, so hopefully it was an interesting exercise to actually see what the labs were, and so I hope everybody got something from that. What I'd like to now do is, unless there's any further questions, comments about the lab tour, okay, I'd like to continue our unit on folding. We had talked about RNA/DNA folding on the class before I left. Let's just try and see if this actually works. It's a nice attempt. Let's see if we can focus up. Jeff? Can you hit one of the lights there? It's not going to do it. It's enough. Okay. So last we talked about DNA slash RNA folding, and this has a, you know, that's where it was sort of our start. If you want to think of it as a start of our unit, worrying about the shape of the shape of structures. Now, protein folding is probably an even more important problem.
It's a more important problem than RNA folding. RNAs are important structural elements. But proteins are the most important structural elements. You know, the
molecules that generally do things
in the cell are for the most part proteins. And what they do and why they do it is a result of the shape of the protein.
Okay, so protein folding is really the problem of trying to predict the shape of a protein molecule.
You're given, in some sense, the chain of amino acids, the sequence of amino acids. And you would like to try to predict what the shape of these protein foldings are, what
the shape of the protein molecule is. And this term folding, to my mind, is somehow this idea that you've got this long strand of molecule.
At least to me, it connotes this idea that various joints are bending, and it's forming some kind of a three-dimensional configuration.
So when you go to talks about, you know, proteins, you tend to see a lot of pictures that look like this, okay? And these are, I find them very difficult to read or understand, but this is what biologists tend to think of as protein structures. You tend to see, I mean, there's lots of different ways you can represent, draw a picture of proteins. Remember, proteins are made of chains of amino acids. So one way you could expect to see the structure of a protein represented would be as a sequence of balls, that, you know, as a chain of balls where each ball might represent that amino acid. A sort of more common way to sort of see the meaningful structure of it, of proteins, tends to be with these so-called ribbon diagrams. Okay, people always flash these ribbon diagrams up. And they sort of model the protein as, here we have actually two interacting proteins. Okay? Each protein is a linear molecule. There are two ends. Here is one end, and here is the other end. If you look at the molecule, you'll see that these thin parts, which represent a structure we'll call loops, that are relatively flexible and unimportant. There are these flat arrows that represent somehow what I think of as long, flat structures, okay, in the protein. They're usually here called sheets. And you see these very twisty, curvy arrows, like here. Those represent things called helices, okay? And so one abstraction of the shape of a protein is to try to figure out, basically, that what proteins, as I understand them, seem to consist of are sort of layers of these sort of flat structures that tend to bind together to form sheets. There are these twisty regions called helices that are fairly stable and rigid. And then there are these sort of loose things. The rest of the sequence is somehow relatively loose and disjoint and free to move.
Okay, so the structure is not as rigid. Okay?
And so in trying to predict the protein structure, what you're really interested in knowing is what is the shape of the three-dimensional molecule that you get as a result of it. And one way you could measure the shape is by plotting the position of every amino acid. The other is to sort of describe it in terms of these higher order structures,
sheets and helices. Okay?
And and then what you would like to do is to figure out, once you have these sheets, how do pairs of proteins interact? Okay, and so given these two ribbon diagrams, you can sort of see somehow, I guess if you're used to reading these protein structures, that this is sort of capable of binding and docking with that. Okay, and so this might show how these two proteins interact with each other.
Okay, any questions about these ribbon diagrams? Okay, again, I have
gone to these talks for many years and never figured out how to read one of these ribbon diagrams in any sense. But you can, if you look at these, see that there are really, proteins can take on lots of
folded a variety of very bizarre and well-defined shapes. Okay, this picture, which again you can see better in color, on the website, is a protein. Again, there's one end is here, the other end is presumably over here. This is two these beta sheets that you have here. There is a nested barrel of beta sheets, like these beta strands, like the ribs of a barrel here. There's nested beta strands like the ribs of a barrel here. And this is a picture we get looking down into the protein, okay? Where you've got this sort of, if you looked at it on the side, you would see ribs, okay, representing those flat arrows. And so you get really a circular structure with a hole in it, formed by twisting layers and layers of protein around, okay? Where you've got sheets on this side, sheets of this side, and the net result is the structure has a hole in it, okay? And so predicting the protein structure, the three-dimensional protein folding problem, would be, given as input the sequence of amino acids, try to figure out that it folds into this shape. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. These are not the same protein. This is not the same protein as this. Okay? But to see what this is, again, the right way to view protein structures, any reasonable biologist will have an expensive workstation sitting at their desk where they can, sort of use graphics and see these models in three dimensions. So you rotate these models around and you can sort of see the holes. Like here you see this tube hole formed. If you looked at it on the side, it would look like a barrel.
Something like, here would be a seat, here would be a barrel, and on the other side there would be these nested seats. Okay? And so the problem of protein folding
is somehow going from the amino acid sequence to this final shape.
Okay? Any questions?
So again, the shapes are important because the shapes govern what the molecules do. Okay? Their shape defines what the interaction is. Somehow the fact that there's this big hole is interesting because maybe things can bind inside the hole or another type of protein can dock with it because of that structure. And so on. Now, one thing to note when we talk about protein folding is that the shape of a protein is in some sense a function of the amino acid sequence, but it is also is clearly a largely a function of the amino acid sequence. It is also a function of the environment. Okay. So you sometimes hear people talk about proteins being denatured. When you say that something is denatured, it means that its shape sort of changes and relaxes. And you can sort of change the shape of proteins by heating them or adding certain chemical agents. But in principle, once you remove those agents and set the environment conditions back to what you had before, in general, it will fold back to its original state. Any questions? Okay. So when you hear about protein folding is probably, I would say, the most popular
computational biology problem in the popular press. Okay? You tend to hear about it a lot.
For a couple of reasons. One is it's very important.
If you could predict the shapes of molecules, just by sort of giving their amino acids, you could predict what the shape of these molecules would be. It would be much more easy to design drug agents to, let's say, interact. There's some protein that is bad in some way, or you're missing some protein, okay, and that's why you're ill or something. You're ill. It might be quite reasonable to design proteins that would do certain things if you could predict what shape the protein would fold into, okay, or find.
It might be reasonable to find the docking sites where proteins are interacting. Okay, given their amino acid sequence. If you predict the shape, it's very important. It's also well known as a problem because it's very computationally hard. Now, experimentally, where do those ribbon diagrams come from? Okay, there are X-ray crystallographers and people who work with NMR, okay, who experimentally study the protein structures. And it is very, very difficult in a lab to try to predict, to compute the, to observe and compute in the lab
what the structure of a given protein is.
The basic technique seems to be that you crystallize the protein, you then shoot X-rays through it or something like that, watch how they bounce. Based on these X-ray images that you get of the protein, you can try to identify where certain atoms are. You'll see pictures that say certain atoms seem like they're bound fairly close together. And then it requires a considerable amount of intellectual work to try to reconcile, figure out how does the underlying amino acid sequence fit with those observed atoms or molecules, you know, those observed atoms and X-ray pictures. So historically, the task of taking a protein and determining its shape is what you would get a biologist or an X-ray crystallographer might do for their PhD dissertation. They'll say, here is a protein, you figure out what the shape of it is, okay, and come back in 5 years, okay? That is historically more or less true, okay? It's probably, as time's gotten, I don't know if anyone wants to argue with it. Is that more or less true? More or less true. Okay. So this is a hard problem, and it's a very important problem. Okay. And so you know, there are databases of protein structures. The Protein Data Bank. Okay, is a very famous database of proteins. It used to be based at Brookhaven National Lab out here. Okay. And what they do is that's sort of the repository for all of these X-ray structures that are determined by X-ray crystallography and so it's an important thing. Something like on the order of, I will say, about 3,000 proteins have their structure known, okay? Maybe it's 12,000, maybe it's less, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. So there's a lot of them, but not the majority of proteins. And if you think about it, every gene in every species, okay, yields a protein, possibly several proteins if you've got alternate splicing. So there's a lot of room to be done in trying to determine the shapes of proteins. Now, when you think about these protein structures and how they get formed.
Again, proteins are chains of amino acids. And the way I think about these amino acids are bonded in the chain. There is a bond that has a certain amount of flexibility here. The reason why proteins fold is I think of the amino acids as being solid things. But they are bonded by the bond has some flexibility to rotate. Okay? And so in some sense, determining the shape of a protein sequence, okay, is determining the angles between a successive joint. You want to describe this protein structure. You know the amino acid sequence. You can describe it completely by the two-dimensional structure, by specifying these angles. So if it was a two-dimensional structure in n dimensions, yeah, it would n, bends, okay, with n bonds or n residues, n angles suffice to describe that protein structure. In fact, to three dimensions, so it's n solid angles that would be needed to describe a protein structure. Okay? Does everybody sort of believe that? That somehow that we can describe this thing, we can describe the angles between each bond. Okay? And note that getting one of these angles wrong can have a big impact on the shape of the structure. You've got, if you think about it, if you make this nice structure, you bend it, suddenly this whole wing flips up 90 degrees. Okay? Getting one of these angles wrong will certainly could potentially have a large impact on the shape of the structure. So the problem of protein structure prediction, in some sense, is determining each of these angles to enough accuracy to enable you to reconstruct the protein. And again, the angle that you usually hear story is, you know, you can maybe make the problem discrete by describing the possible angles, by quantizing them in a small number of ranges, you know, maybe a little, you know, maybe break the range of possible angles into 7 subranges. If you've got 100 residues and each angle is quantified in 7 places, that means that the protein has 7 to the 100 possible configurations you can study.
which is clearly too large to exhaustively search. Okay? And it's already sort of an approximation when you start quantizing these angle ranges. Okay? So this is in the gross reason why protein folding is a hard problem. Okay?
Any questions, Jeff?
They don't form loops.
They don't form loops. Okay, so proteins do not form loops in the sense that we start out, remember, if the protein was synthesized one amino acid at a time, these structures remain. So in some ways, it's not like the protein reconfigures into a closed loop. What we describe as a loop is the result of bending this sort of long chain in this chain into some other structures. So you can imagine taking a piece of wire, bending it like this. I now have a loop, but it's not a circle. Okay, it's a, this is sort of, you know, on top of this thing is on top of that. So it's sort of, you can form spirals. Okay, but there's the underlying backbone. The backbone of the protein is a linear chain. Okay, what we're really doing is bending this chain. Okay, to create other structures. So if you looked at this thing, going back to here,
you know, you can sort of imagine, I mean, I can't read these things, but I see these long strands. It's clear to me that these strands are supposed to function as a flat surface together. Okay? They're not, the backbone of the protein walks along the ribbons. But still, the fact that you have a nice flat structure here, the atoms sort of do interact. And, you know, the amino acids do interact on some level there. Okay? Question?
How does this only be determined by the
Well, in principle, they can be completely described by the bends and the angles. Okay.
Suppose I say you know what's the amino acid sequence. You know what the chain of amino acids is in that particular protein. Okay? You know that each one of these is, for our purposes, a solid thing. And what's interesting is there is a chain of bonds that link amino acids. The flexibility of the structure. Okay, it's basically the flexibility that these bonds have some ability to wiggle and rotate. Okay? So it's sort of like you have, you know, you have a bunch of balls connected by, let's say, a paper clip. Okay? A paper clip, there's a certain amount of room and give you can bend on the paper clip. Okay? And that sort of bending, that really the bend between the balls. Okay, is the flexibility of the structure. And so that's really going to be described by what is the angle. You know that you're not really changing the length of the difference between the bonds. The bonds have a particular length that's fixed. The amino acids have a length that's fixed. To my understanding, at least in the abstraction that we typically use, really what you're going to describe is an angle between successive bends. And if you fix the length of each of these links, and you give me the angles, the structure is completely described up until rotation. So describing the angles is enough to tell me what the structure is. Yes? Also, so the problem is that determining what the right angle is a global problem. This thing is going to fold up into some shape, and trying to predict that. There's no reason why you can really expect to predict that angle looking in isolation at three amino acids. It might be that the reason why this is flat is because this other piece here that is going to sort of force it into that configuration. But the observation is that the answer to a protein folding program
can be described by simply a list of n angles, the angles between each success, the solid angles, or two n angles to be precise. The sequence of solid angles between every pair of faces. Okay, any questions? Yeah. Okay, the folding, again, in biology, nothing is always true. Okay, is the first observation. Okay, so certainly in some sense, we've already discussed that it isn't always unique because we know that we can heat proteins to cause them to change different structure. Okay? So the protein structure is not something that is completely you know, you give it an amino acid sequence, there is not necessarily one structure to it. Okay? Now, in any, the more interesting question is, in any given environmental condition, is there one structure to it? Okay? And that, the answer is, I would say probably not, although it's usually the case that that a small number of structures predominate. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that. Okay? Excuse me? Right. I see. So what you're saying is, if I'm telling you that that this folding is not unique, okay, why is it that they can show this picture and have it has meaning? Okay? And well, one reason is that it's probably the case that, that the important parts of the protein folding are relatively unique. Okay? If you look at these sheets, okay, if they may be that they are reinforced by other sheets. These sheets are sort of fairly rigid. The loops that connect the sheets and the helices tend to be freer to wiggle. So certainly when you publish, let's say, a protein structure, the most interesting parts, okay, are probably more rigid, okay, and more consistent across folds and molecules than the other than these other parts. Okay? So you're trying to get, you know, in the X-ray crystallography, you're getting a picture of the structure. Okay? But in principle, from looking at a picture like that, biologists seem pretty good at being able to identify the important features of the structure, where the sheets are and where the helices are, and the parts that interact with. And if the shape of the protein is important, and these are the important parts of the protein, they will probably fold reliably. Okay, is my way of thinking about this. Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm saying making one bend wrong might make for a big change in the structure. On the other hand, it also might not. If you picture this thing as being a few important structures connected by a lot of relatively loose loops.
Okay, in the loose loops, you know, here I have a nice loose loop. If I instead predicted it as going like this, I've changed all these angles by a lot, but nothing interesting has happened to the shape of the observation. Okay? It turns out that in the case that when you talk about these protein structures, there are parts that seem to be more important and interesting than others. Okay? And in fact, in really accurate prediction, what people really want is an accurate prediction of the important parts. Okay? And the important parts, they're important because they have to be, you know, they have to be this way. And so those are presumably rigid across almost all holdings. Okay? Any questions? No, I mean, in some sense, we predict a structure like this. To make this bent line deterministic, you have to predict the shape of the angle appropriately. I mean, if I say this is 60 degrees. What?
Given the other side, then you want to do
it. Yeah, so I mean, it's worth that. I mean, the structure is unique up until symmetry, so it's certainly true that maybe for the first bed, if I instead thought of it as 160 degrees, 120 degrees, and flip the whole structure over, that would be the same protein. But I can't play that trick too many times before I change the structure of this thing. So really what I'm trying to do is to predict the shape of a bent, you know, a bent piece of wire. You have the sculpture that is the result of a bent piece of wire. Okay, and it's free to rotate and translate into plane. So if you turn to you stand on your head, it's the same protein as it was before. Okay? But in order to, you know, you could not sort of fold this joint instead of saying this is 90 degrees here, if you predicted it as being 270 degrees here, that would pull the whole structure out, it would look quite different. So the angles have to be basically consistent.
Yeah, yeah.
And in 60 degrees is a directed 60 degrees, it's not either or. Any questions? Well, part of making the prediction, again, if we view this world, we describe this idea that maybe we would quantize our angle space into seven regions. So you might say that between 10 and 20 degrees is one guess, or 20 and 30 degrees is another guess. Okay? So you don't necessarily have to get the exact angle down to five decimal places. Okay? But it's important to know whether it's bent to the left or to the right. And then if it bends to the left, does it bend sharply to the left or sharply to the right? Okay? In fact, the degree of flexibility of these angles is somewhat constrained. I mean, you've got this bond, you know, these two atoms that are bonded. I mean, you know, if you think about it, it's a chain of three things. There is not enough sponginess in this bond so that it can fold all the way on itself. So there is a range of angles that are allowable for these bonds. Okay? And, you know, that interval is what you would like to divide up and predict. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
So, okay. So anyway, so when people talk about protein folding, they want to try to predict that sequence of angles, and it's an important problem, and if you think about it, it's also a problem that attracts a lot of scoundrels, because first of all, it is an important problem. It is also something that, since all you have to do is predict these angles, it's very easy to write a program to predict angles, okay? You can pick random angles even, okay? And the question that is hard is should your predictions be trusted, okay? And so it's an area that attracts a lot of work because in some sense it's relatively easy to get into, okay, once you understand the geometry of physics, but it's difficult to do right. Any questions? Yeah. So the question is, how do you verify the prediction of a particular program? Okay, and that is not easy. We'll talk at the later today or next class about how you test protein folding programs, okay, or validate them. And that's actually a very interesting process. Okay, I don't think I want to go into that just yet. Okay, but for the most part, I don't believe it is something that if I give you a prediction, you show it to the biologist, they cannot easily say you're right, okay, or you're wrong. They can look at that and say, well, I don't know, okay? So it's not easy to sort of go from a prediction to a verification, okay? But so the ideal thing is that you get predictions that are good enough that the biologists, have reason to trust enough that they look about it and they think about it, okay? Any questions? Okay. So we talked about this idea of primary, secondary, and tertiary structure. When we talked about RNA folding, the same terms come up in protein folding. Okay, the primary structure is just the sequence, the amino acid sequence of the protein. And that we all know is a 20-letter alphabet. That's fine. That's a sequence like all others. The secondary structure of a protein is different than whether or not, than the secondary structure of RNA. When people talk about secondary structure prediction, they mean taking the amino acid sequence of the protein and identifying which parts are alpha helices, beta sheets, or connecting loops. So if we look at one of these ribbon diagrams. Again, here we see we've got sheets, we've got helices, and we've got loops. Figuring out which sheet interacts with which sheet is a three-dimensional prediction problem. But secondary structure prediction for proteins is just taking each amino acid and saying, are you in the sheet or not? Are you in the helix or not? Or are you in a loop or not?
Okay. Any questions?
So secondary structure prediction is a, you know, to me it always seemed a little ill-defined whether something was in the sheet or the helix, okay, or a loop. But clearly biologists feel they can look at a protein structure and tell, you know, is the sheet, helix, or loop. If you had a program that randomly guessed for each amino acid, sheet, helix, or loop, maybe you would expect to get 33% of the bases right.
Okay. Or if you figure out which occurred most frequently, you may just guess all that. Okay.
In fact, the best secondary structure program prediction programs predict about 75% of all bases correct. So the basic gross state of the art of this thing is given an amino acid sequence. Roughly 3/4 of the time, I can guess this is in a loop, this is an amino acid, this is in a helix.
Okay?
That's clearly short of the three-dimensional structure. Okay? But it does help me localize where are the probably interesting points in the protein. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. How good does the program have to be before it's useful? Well, maybe it's got to be better than anybody else's program. It's probably the first observation. Okay? And, you know, my sense of the, I'm not a protein folder. Okay? I don't live in this world. My sense is people basically sort of believe and trust the secondary structure predictions. Okay? There is much less trust of the three-dimensional structure predictions. Okay? But, you know, you're trying to understand how this protein works. You're a biologist originally, you know nothing about the 3D structure. Somebody gives you a program and there suddenly appears a possible structure, you know, it's worth looking at. Okay? So, you know, the answer is these are good enough to be useful, but, you know, but obviously if they were better, they would be more useful. Okay? So I don't know if that answers your question. Okay? But, so how do those secondary structure programs... Oh, that's a great question. Okay, so people usually talk about these things. Again, somehow you always hear alpha helix, beta sheet, or loop. So to me, I think of alpha helix as simply being the shape of that particular helix. It's one word, alpha helix, is my way of interpreting it. Okay? And certainly as a helix, I see that thing spins, I can believe that's a helix. So usually people say alpha helix, beta sheets. Okay? That's just nomenclature. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So how do these secondary structure prediction programs work? Well, we've sort of already seen a technology that can probably do a pretty good job of it. These hidden Markov models. You could very easily imagine that biologists from all the known protein structures.
You can take a lot of known protein structures. For each amino acid, label, is it in a helix, sheet, or loop? Now you've got a training set that for a bunch of amino acid sequences, that for a bunch of proteins are correctly broken into it. You could imagine training a hidden Markov model that has three types of states, the loop state, the helix state, and the sheet state. Okay, and as you walk along the protein, you're either going to stay within the current state that you're in or jump to a different state.
By learning on your examples, you could set the weights right. You could build a hidden Markov model. And then for any new protein that came along, you could run it through, thread it through that new, the hidden Markov model to identify what the states you're in. In principle, you should believe that using hidden Markov model ideas, you can build a secondary structure prediction program. Yeah. Well, no idea is too strong a term, okay? Again, you know, the biologists are smart people, they study these things, okay? But it's a difficult problem. It's not that the computer scientist is busy trying to write this program. The computer scientist may have no idea about these things. You use what information you have, and basically somehow the shape of the protein is somehow a function of its amino acid sequence. Okay? It is basically the case that the secondary structure sequences are a consequence of the amino acid sequence based on local interactions largely, not completely, but largely. So a hidden Markov model can be expected to maybe do a reasonable job. Okay? And, you know, ideally the better program you would build, with the more biological knowledge you could incorporate, the better off you are. But again, you want a program that will predict the shape of new proteins. Okay? So how much you rely on previous structures, you have to be a little careful that you're not just predicting old structures again. Okay, I don't know if that answers your question. Okay, the governing principle is physics. It's not even really biology. This is the shape, what happens to molecules. And so it's physics. You know, you have interacting particles. You know, there's forces of attraction and forces of repulsion. And some things like to be near water and some things don't like to be near water. Okay? So in one sense, one way to think of solving these problems would be to say, I'm going to try to predict the three-dimensional structure. And then once I have the three-dimensional structure, I can read off what is a helix in a sheet. But I told you predicting three-dimensional structure is a harder problem, it seems, than just the local, you know, determining the gross structure. Okay? So this is not a method that works from first principles. It doesn't work from the physics, but it works on your observed examples. Okay? Yeah. Well, you can do various, you know, energy simulations. How well they work, how accurately they work, is limited. Okay? So if you want to predict the secondary structure, you're better off using a method like this than finding the three-dimensional structure and read this, you know, because the three-dimensional structures are less accurate. In fact, it's probably the other way around. You probably want to take a look at the secondary structure as predicted by these programs. And say, huh, there's this loop, there's this helix, there's the sheet. How do the sheets interact? Okay, and you let that help constrain your three-dimensional predictions. Okay? So it's sort of like, you know, for computer scientists, maybe the secondary structure is like parsing the thing. Okay, and the semantic meaning is sort of the harder thing to figure out. You know, ideally you can't really parse something English correctly until you've determined the semantic meaning. But on the other hand, determining the semantic meaning is very difficult, so you start by parsing in a clumsy way. And that maybe is how you might want to think about secondary structure prediction. Okay? Any questions? Okay, yeah. There exist programs that work by picking, you know, looking at phases of the moon. Okay? So there's lots of different algorithms you might use to do this kind of prediction. The ones that seem to be most successful at secondary structure prediction basically are learning from classified data. Okay, that you look at protein sequences that have been annotated, helix, sheet, loop, okay, and you try to train on that. That seems to be the way the best such programs currently work. Okay, that's my understanding of the field. Okay, any questions? Again, in principle, as a scientist, I'd like it to be more based on first principles. Okay, that somehow that we're going to figure out why nature does that. And then once you know why, you figure out the what. But, you know, sometimes it's easier to figure out what than why. And that's really what is happening here. Any questions? Yeah.
If you're making iterations of that, it's the open.
Yeah.
So, by saying that we can see that, it can be
right, so one question would be, I think when we talk about these angles,
what I think you're trying to do is to say, look, here I've got this amino acid, here I've got that amino acid, here I've got this amino acid. Okay? Because of the way that the properties of these things like to have, the angle between these is probably going to be about, you know, 87 degrees. Okay? Okay, so you maybe predict for each triple what might be their preferred angle. But think about it, these things are actual physical objects. What if they have some angles that is preferred drives this thing into that amino acid.
But, I mean, you're assuming that you're going to create
when you plug it, the question of how we make these predictions, the hidden barcode model is using local features, but remember, you're using a local analysis from a dynamic program to figure out an assignment of labels. It makes that prediction that it was some higher order thing. It wasn't looking at some global structure based on local advantages. You know that to be an alpha helix, the length makes a difference. You know, a helix is only a helix if it spins around a couple of times. So once you start thinking alpha helix mode, you probably stay in there for a while. Okay, so there are local interactions. Okay? But the hidden Markov model does have some global, a certain amount of global things as well. Okay? Any questions? But again, this is one point that I haven't made yet. It's true you can think of the three-dimensional structures being this big chain, but realize that two residues can't occupy the same place in space. So if it bends around onto itself, it's got to be a self-avoiding wall, this structure. And when they get close enough to each other, these residues are going to repel each other. So this might be the ideal local angle, but if another residue comes close, then maybe they're going to repel each other in this bend, and the joint is going to bend a little bit to get away from it. Okay? And as we can see, these angles, small changes in the angles can produce big changes in the results. Okay, so that's why it's sort of a hard problem. Yeah. Now you want to predict the three-dimensional structure. Because I'm really guided with the three-dimensional structure. It is probably usually the programs that I'm aware of for doing three-dimensional structures don't work with this Markov model. I may be wrong with that. But my sense is this Markov model is really these angles are somewhat continuous things. Okay? So my sense is that's not how it's really done. Let's just try to walk through some of the issues first. Okay?
So secondary structure programs, we agree, can be built from the hidden Markov model approach. That I think should be convincing from what you know about. You have annotated examples, you can learn from them, you put them in the soup, something will happen, and the people who've done it say it works okay. That should be clear. Now, three-dimensional structure means determining either the angles between the bonds or equivalently the three-dimensional coordinates of the residues in space. Given the amino acid change, one is equivalent to the representation is equivalent to the other. That is the protein folding problem, tertiary structure prediction. In general, the three-dimensional structure programs work what I will say by doing, you know, that they work by basically doing physics and particle simulation. Okay? You can sort of picture now the protein as being this configuration in high dimensional space. You've got this bond angle space. Okay, if you've got 100 angles, 100 three-dimensional angles, you've got a two-dimensional problem, a 200-dimensional problem. Because each solid angle is specified by two, you know, planar angles. And the way these programs typically work is they define some kind of a global energy function that stores
for a particular protein sequence and a particular configuration assigns it a score, an energy score. And somehow what nature is going to do is in principle fold this thing into the minimum, configuration, the minimum energy configuration. Okay? And the analogy that I've heard is that they think of the molecule as sort of like a restless sleeper. I am a protein. I have a certain number of joints that bend, bond angles that bend. Okay? When I settle down to bed at night, I'm sort of squinching myself into the most comfortable position. Okay?
Predicting how Skeena will fold, okay, is you have, Skeena has some optimization function, some constraints as to what angles can bend. I can't put my head with, and my leg at the same place simultaneously. Okay? The question is to try to find what setting optimizes that objective function. So these, in general, these three-dimensional protein structure programs
have two main components if you want to get into the protein folding business.
The first question is, what is the energy function that you select? Okay, how do you measure how good a folding is? Okay, what the energy of the folding is. And second, how do you search the search space? We agree that the search space is too large to exhaustively search it.
Okay.
And we agree that to do this right, you need to have somehow the right objective function. And the first problem is that there is no, generally agreed upon right objective function.
Nature is in principle folding these proteins, so nature knows what to do. Okay?
So, reasonable things you can put in your objective function are that we know that certain amino acids tend to be either hydrophobic, meaning they dislike water, hydrophilic, meaning they do like water. Okay? Water means that sort of, the water, since most proteins are living in a wet environment, that really means that the hydrophobic residues want to be inside the shell of the protein, and the other stuff wants to be on the outside of the protein. So certainly you have, you know what the properties of each amino acid are. You can factor that into your objective function. You know something about the bend angles that are allowed between different amino acids. You know something about the size of the amino acids. Okay? You know something about the electrostatic forces, that these amino acids are charged particles. Okay? And, and how these charges interact, the electrostatic and van der Waals forces, help govern how this thing bends. Yeah. It would presumably, in a different environment, the protein might very well be shaped differently.
Okay? But of course, you're interested in the environment that is inside the cell. And if you, cut me open, I'm wet. Okay? So, in general, you're in a wet environment. Okay? So the interesting proteins, the interesting environment biologically is in general a wet environment. Okay? Any questions?
Okay. Essentially, I lost a slide. Let me just give me 1 minute. Okay, I'll go back and do this one. Okay, so how is it that these the idea should be, the reason why I don't get interested personally in de novo, meaning from, de novo is Latin for ab initio, okay, which means sort of from scratch, okay. These problems work sort of just given the amino acid sequence, try to predict the structure. Okay? These problems really are doing particle simulation, and this is physics. Okay? This is not combinatorics in some sense, in general, at least with these kind of models. So getting into this business means you have to get your objective function right. Okay? The other thing that you need to do is to have a reasonable optimization function to search this search space. And there's all sorts of different ideas for doing searching a high-dimensional search space for a local optima or a global optima. Gradient descent search means you keep bending things so long and only record it, and accept any bend that will lower the energy cost. And that, if you do it long enough, will guarantee you a local minimum. But it's not necessarily clear that local minimum is the, in fact, globally best solution. Other search techniques is things like simulated annealing, which will basically try random bends, randomly change angles, see how it scores. If it leads to a better scoring solution, we take that bend. If it leads to a worse scoring solution, we flip a coin and decide whether we'll take that anyway. Okay? This has the advantage that it won't get trapped in a local minima so fast. Okay? And potentially has the ability to explore a wider variety of search space. Okay? This is somewhat ad hoc, fuzzy kind of thinking. But, in fact, simulated annealing should give you a better solution than just doing a greedy search. Okay? Although it'll take longer to converge. You hear about all kinds of other heuristic ideas, like genetic algorithms is another optimization idea people use. My sense is what optimization procedure you use isn't as important as getting your energy function right. You're finding the optimal solution of the wrong objective function. Terrific, okay? So that's one of the things that makes it a tough problem. That said, a lot of people use, there's a lot of interest in using high-powered computers to do protein folding, parallel computation. So one product that's got a lot of notoriety is IBM has a BlueGene project, which is in some sense trying to build this supermassive parallel computer so that they can search as large a possible space for protein folding. Okay? Again, if they got the energy function wrong, then it doesn't matter how fast they can search the search space. Okay? But at least they seem to believe that if you can search fast enough, maybe you'll find better solutions. Okay? Any questions? Now, what I think of, again, my sense is that one of the more successful de novo protein folding programs is something called the Rosetta Stone method, okay, which does the following kind of an idea. That basically they look at, you want to fold a particular amino acid sequence.
And say, what were the angles formed by AM and N? Look for, let's say, common protein sequences that have occurred in known structure, the subsequences of the amino acid chain. See what they are, what known structures they have appeared in. Based on that, maybe you can make some initial guess of the local angle, sort of what you want to do. Okay? And then once you've got sort of these local candidates that have been observed, then try to stitch them together using some kind of a global optimization method like simulated annealing. Yeah. Well, why will it have better results? The observation here, now we're talking about three-dimensional structure prediction and not two-dimensional structure prediction, first of all. So here I want angles back, not just helix sheet bend, a helix sheet loop. Okay? But in principle, the amino acid composition should have, one of the interesting things is that protein structures tend to be conserved. Okay? One of the structures, the important part of the structure, okay, is that it holds on lots of proteins, typically. So you would expect that if you did have a sequence of bend angles, it's quite possible that you observe someplace that might be significant. It's not always significant. But so this kind of approach is sort of some kind of a combination of locally observed folds and stitching them together in the right way. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So that is de novo prediction. I'll go back to this. Now, how can you judge how good a job you do with protein folding? Okay, so now we've got this idea that in principle, you now know how to write a protein folding program, right? You can sort of, do your particle simulation, that opposite things attract, similar things repel, okay? You can come up with an energy function. Now, how do you convince a biologist that your protein folding program is any good? Okay? And this is a tricky business, okay? So,
The way that I would probably, the first way that I would think about doing it would be to say, hey, why don't I
take an existing, a null three-dimensional structure. Now what if this thing given a null three-dimensional structure? I will take that protein sequence folded up in my program, and I get this. I can now take this protein sequence, twist it around and align it so that these two things sort of overlap as much as possible. Sort of translate and rotate this thing to try to identify the maximum three-dimensional alignment between them. And then measure the distance between each predicted base and the observed base. Okay? Does everybody see that? That will give me some kind of a measure of how well I folded this thing. Well, how do you get the originals? Like, that's something that's sitting in the protein data bank that some estimate crystallographer did their PhD dissertation on. Okay? So that will assume it's the right thing. You want to find the right encoder saying when you put the PhD student out of work by having to just run the program. Okay, that's what the degree is. Okay? So what is difficult about this kind of way of keeping score? Okay? Any ideas? Okay. First question is geometrically, it's a tricky problem to try to figure out what is the best alignment of these two protein sequences. Everybody agree with that? There's two nested, twisted things, you know, wire structures. Twisting them and rotating, you've got a lot of, and translating, you've got a lot of degrees of freedom. So trying to compute the best possible alignment of the two structures is not a trivial job. But even once you have it,
okay, yes, you can compute the root mean deviation. The problem is that what the biologists are really interested in is not the alignment of the whole structure, but the alignment of the core structure, those helices and loops, the things that, the helices and sheets, the things that are really doing the business. Okay? So, just saying, well, look, my protein folding gives me a root mean squared error of 10 angstroms. Okay, that on average my bases are 10 angstroms. Doesn't really tell me very much. Because it might be that I'm getting all the loops that don't really matter very much very correct. And the inner core very wrong. Okay? So how does this thing really compare from these folding programs? The interesting thing is that there is a competition.
Okay, there is a, every like 2 years or so, there is something called the CASP competition, okay, which I believe you'll talk about more in next time, okay, where what a biologist does, a guy named John Moult, does the following thing. He knows all those PhD students that are busy computing for their dissertation what the protein structure of a particular protein is. So he knows when the PhD student passed their quals and where they are on this. And if the PhD student is within 9 months of graduation, or says, I'm going to get the protein structure, I think, in about 9 months, John Moult will say, put on his web page saying, okay, guys, all you protein predictors now, you have 6 months to predict what is the structure of this unknown protein. Okay? And all the good protein programs will make their predictions. And then when they publish the actual structure, then you can sort of compare. See, one thing that's bad is when you try to predict against past training data, previously observed programs, it's proteins, it's very, very easy to write a program that will successfully predict exactly what is in your test data. Okay? To really validate your predictions, you need to validate it on other things. The set of protein structures that are known is small enough that it's really hard to, sort of separate your training data from your testing data. And so what this CASP competition does is it does is an organized forum where people are judged on predicting new structures that they don't know the answer to. Okay? And, you know, this has become sort of the accepted forum. And anybody who has software in this, if they trust their software, they will try to compete. Okay? And see how they do. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So we'll hear more about that a little bit later. Okay. Fair enough. Any questions about de novo predictions? Okay, so it should be clear that predicting things, you know, just from the sequence is hard. It should be clear that that testing whether your program is good, okay, is a tricky business, okay, and that separating the performance of a new prediction from past training data is a tricky business. Okay, so those are basically what I've been saying so far. Any questions? So what I would believe is if you were interested in the properties of a protein, if you had a computational prediction that you trusted enough, you would probably make, you know, perhaps design experiments based on that to confirm it, okay, or to use that prediction for higher order reasoning. The real question is how much do you trust a particular protein, you know, holding. Okay, and it depends upon what your needs are, what you're trying to do. You know, these protein folding programs are important, okay, even though they're not as good as you would like them to be. Okay, if you make, you know, the better you can make them, the more use they will find. Okay, but it's sort of a slippery slope. You know, there's this knob, you know, as you increase the accuracy of the program, you're going to get more and more applications. Okay, that doesn't mean that even a very clumsy program might not be useful for certain things. Okay, and so that's basically, so we as computational biologists want to make our programs as good as possible. The better you can make them, the more likely you. Here's an area where the predictions are still bad enough that making the prediction a little bit better would be a good thing. Okay, any questions? So, one thing that when we talk about protein folding, again, I told you that protein folding is a hard problem. Okay, and I sort of convinced you from this idea of bend angles that you've got this. The problem is, in principle, has a very high, is a very high dimensional problem. Okay, and that should make it hard to do. Usually, as computer scientists, if you want to say that a problem is hard, the way that you will prove it that it is hard is by giving me a NP-completeness proof. Okay, and sure enough, there are plenty of NP-completeness proofs for certain abstract models of protein folding. So what was our NP-completeness problem? We have a well-defined problem, okay, and we want to show that finding the optimum to that is as hard as some other NP-complete problem. Well, in order to prove that protein folding is NP-complete, you have to come up with a rigorous formal definition of what the folding problem is, meaning like your energy function. And there are a bunch of different sort of NP-hardness proofs for protein folding under different models. So, for example, one model that you might want to consider is suppose we model the protein as being a chain of, you know, amino acids, some of which are hydrophobic, some of which are hydrophilic. And the protein structure has to lodge on the vertices of the grid. So we discretize the problem, where each protein structure is modeled as a walk on a lattice. Okay, now our angles are severely restricted. They can either be 90 degrees, 180 degrees, or 270 degrees. They can't be 360 degrees because they fold up on each other. And maybe we consider this in three dimensions. So under certain rigorous, well-defined protein folding models, like, for example, trying to maximize the number of adjacent hydrophobic pairs in a three-dimensional lattice. That's a well-defined criteria. You can do an NP-completeness proof and show that that problem is hard. Now, this bothers some people a lot, okay? Why? Well, there's something called the Leventhal's paradox, which says that, gee, nature is folding these proteins in a test tube in under a minute. Okay? These protein molecules are somehow smart enough to fold into the right shape. Why is it that if this problem is computationally hard, Why is it that nature can do it so quickly? Okay? And this bothers some people. Okay? It never really bothered me very much. Okay? For a couple of reasons. I don't know if it bothers you or not. Okay? The reason it doesn't bother me is because there's several possible explanations. Okay? One explanation is that the theoretical model used to prove hardness, okay, is not necessarily what nature is doing. Okay? So we have this idea that nature is full. If nature folds things on a lattice and maximizes those pairs, it's hard. But nature isn't doing it on a lattice and isn't maximizing those pairs. Okay? So it's not clear we have a right, sort of model there. Okay? Second, it may very well be that evolution has selected for these proteins. These proteins are designed by nature to do a job. Okay? And it could very well be that evolution, if you had proteins that couldn't fold up regularly to do the shape that was desired, the organism died. Okay? If only half of its protein, if half of the molecules of just the nucleotides folded in one shape and half in another, it didn't do the right thing and the organism was selected against. So it may very well be that evolution has selected proteins for ways that in principle fold easily. Okay? And the final one, which to me is I think most convincing, is it may be that in the right optimization problem, folding proteins to the global energy minimum may very well be hard. Okay? But in fact, nature probably does not always find the global optimum. Okay? That this thing, again, I sort of picture it that as the protein is being synthesized, it's squirting out one end. And as a result of something sticking out there, then it's going to start to fold to something. And some more comes out and folds again. And then maybe that causes it to rearrange. It goes through a sequence of steps in, after assembling to fold into something. Okay? Yeah. Well, okay, I mean, there's other issues. I mean, proteins tend to fold, there's often things called, I think, chaperone proteins. Other proteins help, certain proteins help other proteins fold better. Okay? So it's a more complicated problem than just, you know, what is happening here. So I don't consider this to be such a paradox, but you do hear a lot of people, this bothers a lot of people. Okay? Okay, because in principle, nature is solving this seemingly hard problem, and why can't we solve that? Okay? Any questions? Finally, there's this notion that, again, protein folding is a very tricky business. Many of you, I assume everybody here has heard of mad cow disease, okay? Or, you know, you're not supposed to eat meat, or at least parts of meat, okay? Because, you know, you'll get these brain diseases. And what makes these kind of diseases very interesting is normally, when you catch a disease, I mean, you know, you think about what are the causes of diseases. One cause of a disease would be that you have a genetic problem, you're not making proteins right, and then you have a disease that's inherited. Okay, that I can understand. Or you might have a virus. Okay, a virus comes in and starts making proteins that are bad, or starts doing bad things to your cells. That you can understand. Or a bacteria comes along and, you know, you have this bacteria as an infectious agent, okay, and it does some damage. That's well understood. Diseases like mad cow disease seems to be caused by things they call prions, which are infectious agents that are probably proteins that somehow seem to work by convincing other proteins to fold in the wrong way, okay? This is probably not a very precise statement. Okay, but somehow the causes of these diseases seem to be that proteins start folding in the wrong way. Okay, probably that these prions, this other agent, somehow again causes it to fold in a different way, and then it's a non-functional way. Yeah. Right. Wrong way is not the way that the organism wants the protein to do. So it may be that it's better from a physics point of view, but it's bad for the cow, okay? It's bad, you know. And so we're really interested in the shape. The protein has a role biologically to function, okay? And we want to operate in that space. Any questions? Okay, so next class we're going to look, any questions about protein folding? Next class we're going to talk about another approach to protein folding, something called threading, and we're going to have an overview of protein folding programs and similar software to see how they actually work, from a biologist who knows something about it. Any questions? Okay, thanks a lot. See you next class. Thank you.